The following presentation is a Vintage Quixotic production.
Tomorrow, blow your speakers with Guns N' Roses, Guns N' Roses, and Guns N' Roses. Three in a row, every hour on the hour. MTV's Guns N' Roses Monday, right here.
Jungle Natives, the all-new, unofficial Guns N' Roses podcast.
Then when she said she's gonna, like, wreck my car, I know what to do.
Here's your hosts, Brooke Ellis and Christina Rice.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Jungle Natives, the all-new, unofficial Guns N' Roses podcast. I'm Brooke Ellis, and with me, as always, is the wildly prolific and lovely Christina Rice.
Hi there.
In our third episode, Appetite Devours, we are going to examine GNR's gradual permutation into pop culture via mainstream media, magazines, radio, and TV to their ultimate domination of the rock scene. But before we get to that, I want to mention something. I want to give a shout out to our friends over at mygnr.com and GNR Truth. And an honorable mention to Here Today, Gone to Hell, even though we don't actually have any friends there. But I did a web search for Jungle Natives to see if anybody was talking about us, and sure enough, nobody was. But I did come across a thread in a forum that asked about GNR podcasts, if there were any good ones out there. And somebody responded, no, they are not. Don't waste your time with what's out there. I was going to do one myself, but you'll have to wait until I get around to it. So I registered over there, and I said, well, hey, I've got a GNR podcast that you might enjoy. And some people checked it out, and somebody posted, you know what, I listened to it, it was enjoyable, but at some point the host said that the current status of GNR is sad. That guy doesn't know what he's talking about. GNR is doing better than ever. There will be an album in 2015, there will be a tour, and Axl still loves us. And of course, I'm paraphrasing completely, but people chimed in, and they were like, thanks for the heads up, I'm not going to listen to this podcast if they spread hate and gossip. But the type of topics that you'll find, and this is GNRtruth.com, a lot of great people over there, but there's like a poll, for instance, who is your favorite GNR bassist? Christina, who's your favorite GNR bassist?
Well, I only know one, Duff McKagan. I adore him.
Yeah, I'd say he's my favorite, too.
Yeah, I think so. I couldn't even tell you who else has played bass for that band.
Some of the purists over there will tell you, oh, well, there was a French guy before Duff or something to that effect, but now they have Tommy Stinson, who's probably the only member of the current incarnations of GNR that I kind of like. But anyway, for the most part, these people were cool over there at GNR Truth, and I, you know, wanted to be friendly with them. And I said, well, look, if you have any questions about Steven Adler, my time, you know, when I was his friend, when I worked with him and I worked on the book, feel free to ask. So they asked a few questions, and I really took my time and was thorough. And it was sort of an exclusive for them. Not that I'm anything special, but I gave them some sort of insider information. But the only thing they could concentrate on was any mention of Axl that I made. And, for instance, I would say something, and they were like, well, actually, Brooke, you said Axl did this, but in fact, he didn't. So opinions, no opinion is right. Everything is subjective. What you like is what you like, and enjoy it and have that passion, and that's great. I mean, what's your opinion of the current incarnation of Guns N' Roses?
Well, and again, this is just my opinion, and I'm not trying to start wars with anybody on a message board. You know, for me, like, I lived, breathed, sweated, cried Guns N' Roses, you know, throughout my teenage years. I mean, they were literally what I woke up. I woke up because there was going to be a second Guns N' Roses album. So I invested a lot in this band in my youth. And so, you know, and I still have a tremendous amount of respect for Axl. I just always kind of took exception to him calling it Guns N' Roses, because I really do feel that Guns N' Roses is, you know, it is Slash, it is Duff. I always missed Izzy. So, you know, to an extent it was Izzy and to an extent it was Steven, but I really felt that the heart and soul of that band was Axl, Slash, and Duff. And so, to me, it just doesn't sit right calling it Guns N' Roses, you know. And when Axl, like, first started touring, people would come up to me going, oh my God, Guns N' Roses is coming. Are you going to go see them? And, you know, and these weren't diehard fans who followed the band. And I think a lot of people just, I think it was unfair, because people weren't aware what was going on. And if they went in concert to see Guns N' Roses, they weren't seeing Slash, they weren't seeing Duff. And so,
right, well, most of those people didn't even know.
No.
I mean, the general rock audience for years had no idea that this wasn't the guy with the top hat. Well, everybody knew the name Slash, for one thing. But you're right, like in 2007, when Guns N' Roses played the Inland Invasion, my brother was like, why aren't you at the Inland Invasion? I'm like, dude, that's not Guns N' Roses.
That's not Guns N' Roses. So, yeah, again, I don't belittle anyone, but it never sat well with me that he called it Guns N' Roses. And I don't know for sure if the story about him, about Axl strong-arming them into legally signing over the name Guns N' Roses in Wisconsin is accurate or not. If it is accurate, then, you know.
It seems to be. I mean, both yeah. Duff and Slash have sort of verified it. Doug Goldstein, who I don't know if you could take his word for it, because he sounds like he desperately wants to get back into the GNR fold from this interview he did with Mitch LaFon recently, but he tried to discount that entire thing. But the thing about the current incarnation of Guns N' Roses is it's not what we grew up with. It's not what so endeared us to them and the music at the time. And I think that's a fair explanation. You know, I think a good analogy is I like Star Trek, the original series. My friends, they love Star Trek, The Next Generation. And we can argue till we're blue in the face, but nobody's right.
Right.
It's what you like, and that's cool. So for those of you who love the new Guns N' Roses.
Yeah. That's fine. Yeah, and I probably, like, I have not listened to Chinese Democracy, in all honesty. My brother bought it for me. If it wasn't called Guns N' Roses, I'd probably listen to it, but I just can't. And as much, you know, I was always a very, you know, I was the diehard Slash fan. If Slash went out there calling a band Guns N' Roses, I wouldn't be supportive of that, because I feel like Guns N' Roses was just a very special thing that happened in a special time. So
exactly.
Again, not trying to start fights with anyone, but I was surprised that people were so passionate, and that's great. Passion is fantastic, but I was, I've been out of the loop for a long time. So.
Right, and I've been visiting GNR Truth since, although I haven't posted, and I like a lot of the stuff that they post in there. But I gained a new respect, and I hope I'm not getting anybody in trouble with this, for Del James. Back in 2007, I interviewed him for Classic Rock Magazine, and that evening he was playing some benefit at the Cat Club, not the Cat House, but the Cat Club, which used to be located right next to the Whiskey. And I was speaking with him, and he actually said to me, Axl should have gone out as Axl Rose, just like Ozzy did from Black Sabbath to go on and have that major success, and Axl could have done the same thing. He didn't need to call it Guns N' Roses. I don't know if that's ever been revealed that Del James had that opinion. But that's what he said to me, and hopefully it's okay for me to repeat that.
I would have gone and seen Axl live.
Of course.
If he just called it Axl or something.
You know, in that last episode, I mentioned how Rocket Queen, I thought, was Axl's finest moment. And I've been listening to GNR lately. And you know what his second finest moment, possibly the moment that really defines Axl as one of the greatest rock vocalists of all time, is? From Lies, You're Crazy, the acoustic version of You're Crazy. I mean, the guy is just fierce in that, and he really establishes a new bar. He sets the bar high for rock vocalists, and I love the guy, and I have no disrespect for the man. But anyway, back on topic.
But a lot of frustration at times.
Well, here's the thing, and again, this is just an opinion, but Axl's living his life, and why not? You know, I think he's living the good life. He's working as much as he needs to support the lifestyle that he's become accustomed to. He's eating well, obviously, and he's dating some of the most beautiful women in the world that I've seen in pictures. He's living the good life. I don't think he's as passionate as an artist as he used to be, and I'm going to get hell for this. But when you're an artist, you want people to hear what you're working on. This is my new baby. Check this out. But I think it's the hunger that drives a lot of artists, and he's content, and that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. And again, that's just an opinion, but I would love to see new material from Axl that blows me away, and let's hope for that. So anyway, back on topic, Appetite Devours, the onslaught of popularity that Guns N' Roses experienced in the mid-80s. In the last episode, we had spoken about the Ritz briefly. But what I want to get to is the 1988 MTV Awards. How well do you remember this event?
The MTV Awards, I remember really well. I just want to backtrack just briefly.
Of course.
Because I don't want to Axl bash. So I want to say, conversely, like the Ritz, you watch him at the Ritz, and that is why I loved him. Like there was a period in time where I loved Axl and he could do no wrong. And I think you watch him at the Ritz and you just watch him as this incredible performer, and you watch him interacting with the crowd, and he interacts with the crowd in just such a positive, wonderful manner that like that's the guy I loved. So I had love. I had lots of love at one time.
And did you know that the Ritz show almost didn't happen?
I did not know that.
According to Steven Adler, before the show, Axl could not find his bandana. The show was running, the night was running late. Guns N' Roses were already past their start time. And he's like, I will not do the show unless I find my bandana. And of course, I'm paraphrasing, but this is how it was told to me. And finally, somebody came up with this blue sparkly thing that he ends up wearing in the mm-hmm. show. And the cameraman, according to Steven, were all ready to disband and break down and take off. And Steven said, no, please, please, just stay here. We're going to go on. So Steven credits himself for that show going on by keeping the cameraman there. And he says that's why he's featured so much, is because he was cool with the cameraman. Whether or not that's true, that's what he told me. But you talk about how cool Axl is. And, the moment when he jumps into the audience during Paradise City, And there's the one black guy in the audience grabbing him. There's always the one black guy at rock shows. But anyway, they're tearing at his
shirt off.
But when he gets up, and you see Izzy in frame, and he, without missing a beat, starts dancing and starts singing, and you see the biggest smile on Izzy's face.
See him cracking up, yeah.
It's awesome. And Axl was awesome. And good times. Yeah. So anyway, yeah, the MTV Awards 1988.
Oh, yeah. That was huge for me. I was 14 at the time. It was my freshman year of high school. And yeah, I remember being poised in front of the TV, anxiously awaiting, because I had to press record on the VCR. So I was just ready. And my mom was sitting there with me. And this wouldn't be the first time that my mom would liken my fanaticism towards Guns N' Roses with hers for the Beatles. And she did compare it. Not that necessarily it does compare it, but she did compare me anxiously waiting for
Guns N' Roses. But I use that analogy all the time for people who are like, ooh, Guns N' Roses. Well, yeah, just like people love the Beatles.
Yeah. See, I didn't even have to say. So she did liken it to when she was waiting for them to come on Ed Sullivan. Like, that's how big of a deal it was for Guns N' Roses to come on the MTV Awards. And this was one of my, like, prouder moments of Guns N' Roses, because at the time, bands would lip sync at the VMAs. And so I remember watching all these bands come on and thinking, oh, man, I can't, and Aerosmith came on. And Aerosmith were, I think Steven Tyler was singing, but the band was not plugged in. And I remember sitting there thinking, oh, there's no way. There's no way Slash is going to come out and pretend to play his guitar. And when they came out, they were live, they were plugged in, and I was so just proud, and it was just so raw, and they were so amazing. And it is one of, like, my fondest, strongest memories of Guns N' Roses at that time.
Right. And you know what's funny? The MTV Awards have changed so drastically. When you watch that clip, the audience, nobody in that audience is reacting. Everybody is sitting still. It's like an inanimate audience. Whereas today, they packed the front up with young, hip-looking people who are just going wild. And Steven said at the end of the performance, he threw his drumstick right to Steven Tyler, who was sitting in the front, because they were already friendly at this point. And if Steven Tyler didn't even budge, nobody reacted. I think even the crowd, Phil, was pumped in, like the pre-recorded, applause. But I remember back in New Jersey when that came on, and I also had my VCR queued up, but a lot of my friends were curious to see, what song they were going to play, how they were going to sound. And I remember there was some criticism about Axl's voice, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think Axl even came out a day later and said, well, I had a cold or something. I don't know if the criticism was that widespread, but I seem to recall something like that.
I don't remember. I just remember them being amazing.
Right.
And it was a Welcome to the Jungle, I don't think we said.
Yeah, well, of course. Everybody hopefully knows that, I think. Right?
But to put a finer point on just how big they had become, so Axl had a beard during that performance, yeah, which we'd never seen Axl with a beard before. Right. And so the next day, I'm at school and I'm talking to a friend of mine. I said, oh, man, yeah. And they came out and Axl had a beard. And some girl walking past us in the hall said, oh, Axl had a beard? And that's when I went, oh, God. Like, that's when I knew just
how. But it was
more
scruff, right? I mean,
it was pretty beardy for him at that time.
And he had the Eat the Worm t-shirt, that some type of tequila that has a worm inside the bottle, and you eat it, and supposedly it'll make you hallucinate. And he had Eat the Worm t-shirt.
And do you have a white leather jacket on?
He had the white leather jacket, but he took it off, that's exposing the Eat the Worm t-shirt. Try finding one of those. That would be pretty cool. Because I remember back when he did the Concert for Life and he wore the Kill Your Idols shirt with Jesus. And around that same time, I was down at Melrose and I had a chance to buy that shirt a million times and I never did.
No.
No, so I kick myself about that now.
I did have a Lip Service shirt.
Nice.
Oh yes, I did go buy clothing at Lip Service because of Axl.
Nice. And do you remember what award they won that night?
They won Best New Artist?
Best New Artist.
Is that when Slash came out with Tracy Lords?
Yes, and here is another, you know, revelation that sort of rocked the world. Slash showing up, accepting award with Tracy Lords, because Tracy Lords was at the height of her notoriety at this time. She had just exposed the entire porn industry because she was an underage porn star. It rocked, you know, the industry. It was headline news. And how cool is Slash? Here he comes out with Tracy Lords. And the funny thing is, she introduces herself. I'm Tracy Lords. He goes, I'm Slash. And she goes, and Guns N' Roses are very happy to have this. Thank you. And it was just another feather in the cap of how cool Guns N' Roses were, especially for people my age, you know, in their mid-teens, who were like, oh, my God. You know?
I was very confused. I didn't know what was going on.
So anyway, I think the MTV Awards aired in September or October. And in November, the video for Paradise City premiered. And do you remember the first time you saw that?
I do, only because, you know, on one of the previous episodes, we talked about how I won the contest to go to Castle Donington.
Right.
And so
the footage, the black and white footage is from Donington.
It's from Donington, which I didn't get to go to because I was underage. And so Paradise City was always a very bittersweet video for me to watch.
But you understand it's the first time you saw Slash shirtless, wasn't it?
Was that the first time? I think it was.
Because I remember that was all the buzz with my girlfriend. Oh, he's actually got a good body, you know?
Like, yeah.
And I remember, and it was the first time we saw Axl without like anything to do with his hair. He didn't have his hair puffed up. He wasn't wasn't wearing a bandana.
And I think the first time we saw Slash, or saw Def in a cowboy hat, maybe.
Yeah, that white cowboy hat.
Yeah.
And there's shots of them walking through New York. It's Duff and Steven. Izzy was off doing his thing, like he always was. Izzy, as Steven would say, Izzy is just Izzy. He would just do his thing, and everybody was cool with it. And did you see the Deadpool when it came out?
Opening night.
Really?
Oh, God,
just because you knew Guns N' Roses?
Just because I knew Guns N' Roses was in,
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but did the commercial, the TV commercial for the Deadpool actually say featuring music by Guns N' Roses? I almost think it did. Like, no?
I don't feel like it did. I don't remember.
How did you get the heads up about that they were in the movie?
Golly, I don't know if I mean, I remember there was, like, on the MTV News, an interview with Slash and Duff talking about it, how they had a cameo in it, and then making fun. What did Slash call, like, the guy who was that played the rock star and was lip-syncing Jungle?
Jim Carrey.
Yeah, calling him a dork, because this was before anybody knew who Jim Carrey was.
Pre-superstardom Jim Carrey playing the rock star who sings Welcome to the Jungle.
Fantastic. Yeah, I knew about it somehow. So yeah, I went opening night, and I think the people sitting directly around me and my friend in the theater were ready to punch us, because every time they came on the screen, we started screaming.
That's funny. And they only are in it for a few shots.
Yeah.
But I remember when I went to see it with my buddy, Craig Giotto, and when Guns N' Roses first appear in the cemetery scene.
Yeah.
There's whispers, oh, Guns N' Roses, that's Guns N' Roses, you know, in the audience. You know? So there was that acknowledgement right there. And they're in another scene where they're on a boat and Slash is like on a harpoon gun.
Yeah, it's on the like a film shoot.
Right. Well, this is an interesting factoid. You don't see Axl and Steven in that scene. Steven actually wound up in the hospital. He met a woman on the set of, or on the cemetery set, went back to her place. She gave him a beer and she drugged it. And the last thing he remembered was her straddling him and saying, I'm going to show you how to eat pussy. He blacked out. I think it was a day or two later, he woke up in the hospital. And who was at his bedside? Axl Rose. Nobody else was there. They were out filming that scene on the boat, doing their thing. Axl was concerned, I guess, and he cared enough. And that was something that stayed with Steven forever, that Axl was the one that was waiting for him to awaken, because they didn't know what was going on. I remember it was a pretty serious deal, and you know, it was an OD. I don't know what drug it was, but yeah, pretty profound thing there.
I was not aware.
But luckily he came out of that okay, and then they did the Rolling Stone cover. Gosh, that would have been in November of 88, and I'm sure you picked that up as soon as it came out.
I did. You know, I think I only got one copy of it, which is so unlike me, because I have like 8 copies of the one with Slash on the cover.
You know, and I don't mean to make this a Steve-centric podcast, so please, you know, tell any stories you want, but Steve's wearing a T-shirt that says Hamsters of Rock, and it's a spoof of the Monsters of Rock concert that was going on with Dokken and Metallica and Van Halen headlining. Well, anyway, supposedly, this is what Steve told me, that as a result of him wearing that shirt, Eddie Van Halen left him a message on his answering machine, because this was before voicemail, basically cussing him out. What the hell are you doing with that Hamsters of Rock shirt, making fun of Monsters of Rock? So that's according to Steven Adler, and I believe it because he has no reason to make stuff up. The guy lived an incredible life, and yeah, and we love him for it. And how about the Rolling Stone cover with Slash? Do you recall much about that interview?
About the I don't recall too much about the interview. I just remember it was a wonderful, it's a wonderful cover of a shirtless, big-haired Slash. And when I met him the first time at KNAC, that was the thing I had him sign.
Nice. Yes. You still have that?
I do. It's I think it might be in my storage unit. How terrible. What a terrible Guns N' Roses fan I am now. Well, yes, I do have it.
Nice. Well, I mean, here's the thing. You know, they appear as a band on the cover of Rolling Stone in 88. 89. It was Slash or Axl on the cover first? I think it was Axl first and then Slash. And Axl refused to do his interview with anybody but Del James, his buddy. So he's responsible for getting Del James professional work as a journalist. And I remember his interview was so great where he admitted that he had manic depression. And Basically all it really did was got people off of his back because they were like, oh, he's manic depressive. So just leave him alone. And it was just a funny interview, and Axl was always a character in interviews and always managed to endear people further and to like him more. But that Slash Rolling Stone interview, I remember he really made himself out to be like a hardcore junkie. You know,
Did he? I think, you know, it always broke my heart that Slash was such a junkie. Poor Slash. I really hope he can clean himself up. So things like that just really depressed me because I just wanted them all to live.
Right. And I don't mean to jump ahead, but when Steven Adler was kicked out of the band for drugs, I don't think I was the first one who didn't believe it. Because didn't he look like the clean-cut, happy guy?
Yeah. Well, let me tell you. So, you know, when they opened for the Rolling Stones in October of 1989, so they played four shows, and the first night, I don't know if we touched on this before or not, the first night Axl said he was quitting the band because there were, you know, too many members of the band dancing with Mr. Brownstone, and it was high drama. And the next day, you know, and I was freaking out because that was the first show, and I had tickets to the fourth show. And so I was absolutely freaking out that, you know, that they had broken up before I could see them again. And the next day, you know, at school, like that was the buzz. Like the whole, you know, the buzz is like, oh my God, what happened with Guns N' Roses and what's going to happen to them and who are they talking about? And, you know, and I'm like, oh man, I think they're talking about Slash. And, you know, and it's just breaking my heart. And my friend Nova just jokingly goes, nah, they're probably talking about Steven. And we all just started cracking up because,
right.
No, we didn't think he would be the one. Not at all.
And didn't Slash get up the next night or the night after that and address what Axl said?
He did. So the next night, I think it was KLOS, was broadcasting live because we didn't know if they were going to go on or not. And so my friend Nova, she wasn't a Guns N' Roses fan, but she loved the Stones, and we were going to be going to the concert together that coming Sunday. And she was over at my house, and we were working on a school project, and it's being broadcast live, and we're waiting to find out, is Axl going to go on stage? And before the show starts, my brother bursts into my room and says, oh my God, there is this huge earthquake in San Francisco during the World Series.
That was that same time?
Yes. And he comes in, he's like, there was this huge earthquake in San Francisco. And we're like, wow, bummer. We didn't realize till, you know, much later the extent of the damage. But we're more focused on, oh my God, you know, screw the earthquake rolling in. Is Axl going to go on stage? And so, I might have this cassette tape somewhere because I was recording it. And, you know, like, well, the band's there and, well, they're starting to play. And then Axl came out on stage and all was well with the world.
Wow, I didn't realize that there was that high drama leading up to the 11th hour like that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, at least that's, that's what was presented, you know, to us,
right?
To us as, oh yeah, we were just, and that was, you know, that morning when they were talking, when I heard about, they're talking about it on the radio, and that the Los Angeles Herald Examiner was, they ran a whole big article about it, and I remember running to the donut shop up the street and, you know, getting a copy of the Herald Examiner, to verify, and like, oh my God, they're just spreading lies and being so angry. And now I'm a photo archivist, for the Los Angeles Public Library, and we have the photo archive for the Herald Examiner. So when I started working with the collection, that was the first thing I did, is I went and I dug out the photo that had ran in the paper that day.
Wow.
Which it was a photo from from the MTV Music Award press conference, so it wasn't like a Rolling Stones photo, but yeah, it all came full circle for me.
That's cool.
But yeah, but it was intense. Like, it was intense, high drama if Axl really quit the band or not. And
right.
It was the buzz at Glendora High School. That's how big they were. And so when they finally came on stage, it was just this huge relief, and we're high-fiving each other, and you know.
And you ended up going to that last show.
I ended up going to the last show.
And didn't you say that it was like a life-changing experience?
It was one of the most memorable, to this day even, I don't know if that makes me sound lame or not, it was one of the most memorable evenings, you know, of my life. Like, it was really, it was momentous. It was just fantastic.
Well, take us through it a little bit.
Yeah, so first off, at the time, you know, I was in a house with my mom and my stepdad. And my stepdad, you know, he was an alcoholic, and he was a very volatile person. And so my brother and I, neither one of us, well, I was 15, so I wasn't driving yet. And my brother didn't have a working vehicle. And so my mom was supposed to drive us to our cousin's house, and he lived near LAX. And my cousin was, we were all going to drive to the Coliseum, which is where the Rolling Stones show was. And my stepdad was pissed off about something and forbade my mom to drive us. And so we're freaking out. Like, how the hell are we going to get to LAX?
Now, he knows how important this is to you.
Oh, my God. Yeah, absolutely. And so my brother and I are panicking.
Now, was he an abusive type? Physically abusive?
He wasn't physically abusive.
Oh, that's good.
No, he was never physically abusive. Like, mentally, emotionally, yeah, absolutely. And so, yeah, he had leverage. He always had leverage over me, and usually with Guns N' Roses. And so, you know, finally at the last minute, you know, like, we're begging my mom, my brother and I are crying. And because this is, you know, I'm 15 years old. Like, this is everything.
Wow.
This is the world.
How memorable.
Yeah, this is the. And so, you know, and so my mom finally drives us down. And the whole way over, you know, we're like, and we had to go pick up my friend Nova. So she's in the middle of all this drama. And we're like, well, I hope you realize that your husband just ruined this night for us. And, da, 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 da. And the second she pulled away, we're like, yeah, we're going to see Guns N' Roses. And so we went, and it just, you know, because we were there for hours, you know, because like in Living Color, or not in Living Color, Living Color opened up. We didn't go see them. But, and so my friend and I, we were just kind of wandering around, and we're 15, and it was kind of experiencing a semblance of independence for the first time.
Nice.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, of course.
And then I see Guns N' Roses, like this band that, you know, seeing your favorite band live at that age, like there's nothing as amazing as that. And they were awesome. Like, they were absolutely incredible. Again, I think the guy next to me was ready to punch me, except for he was too drunk, because I just was screaming my head off for Slash. I was absolutely screaming my head off. And then during, like, in the middle of Rocket Queen, Axl ran around the track, because there's the Olympic track at the Coliseum.
Right.
It was raining. So you see lots of photos of Slash in a Motorhead shirt, just drenched in rain from that show. Yeah, they were absolutely incredible. And then the Stones came on, like the freaking Rolling Stones.
What a perfect night.
It was a perfect night. Like, it was a perfect night. And, you know, and afterwards we're driving home, and it was so perfect. And this is, you know, what a dramatic teenager I was. It was too perfect. So that driving home, I remember just thinking, oh, I have to go back to my, you know, shitty life now, and it was too perfect a night. And it was fantastic. And I just remember we stopped off at Denny's on the way home, and I went and looked at myself in the mirror, you know, because I'm a kid and I would like pile the makeup on, and because of the rain I looked like Alice Cooper.
Oh wow.
My eye makeup was just running down my face, and my lipstick was smeared. And
but even that's like the perfect ending to
it.
That
was the perfect
rock and roll evening.
Yeah, it was absolutely fantastic.
And, you know, you actually reminded me that Axl ran that track. And I remember reading about it. And when he got back up on stage, he said, I always
wanted
to
run
that
fucker.
Yeah.
Is what he said.
You know, Axl Rose, man, possibly the most fit man in rock and roll. Also possibly the most hardworking, at least back in the day. And I do have a low-quality bootleg of it where you see the security. Like, you don't know what the
heck. Really? We didn't know what was going on. Right. You know, we had like, pretty shitty seats. They were pretty far back. And, you know, and all of a sudden we see, like, a crowd of people run by us on the track. And we're like, what's going on? And somebody goes, oh, my God, there's Axl. And there he was. And he was running so it was him and then security chasing him. And then a bunch of fans started chasing him. And he ran around that entire track.
How awesome is that?
It was amazing. And then got back up on stage and finished singing Rocket Queen.
And not a good night to be an out-of-shape security guard or bodyguard.
Oh, no. I don't think they knew what hit them.
Because that's a quarter-mile track. And, you know, and if you're not in shape a quarter mile, that's not an easy run. I mean, when I was younger, it was an easy run. Nowadays, I can barely make it.
That would have never been an easy run for me. I didn't even bother trying to chase him. And they had those awesome Stoned in L.A. t-shirts, which I think I still have mine somewhere.
Right. In our next episode, I'm going to talk about how I acquired a number of those. But other memorable moments from the Rolling Stones show, Axl falling off the stage. And that's actually on video. I believe it's during Knocking on Heaven's Door, and he's just walking along, and all of a sudden, boop, he disappears. He fell off the stage.
I forgot about that.
Yeah, but he got up, you know, and didn't miss a beat and just kept on singing. Yeah, lots of great moments in those shows. I lived in New Jersey. I didn't actually get to experience them. But at the end of the last show, and you were at the last one,
I was
right?
at the last one.
Something that Steven Adler mentioned to me, that was the only time that the band as a whole, all five of them, took a bow.
Really?
Yeah, at the end of that performance. And there's a picture of it, and that's one of his favorite pictures, obviously, because Steven, you know, loves Guns N' Roses and, you know, and what they were able to do together. And, yeah, so it was a special moment, and unfortunately it was the last, you know, for that lineup. Well, with the exception of Farm Aid.
It was the last show. Wow.
With the exception of Farm Aid. And I guess we could jump ahead to that. I had no idea Farm Aid was going on. Did you have?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I knew it was going on while it was going on. I don't know if it was being broadcast.
It was some weird cable station like TNN or something.
Yeah, like I saw bits and, like, you know, I think like MTV might have recapped it, but I think it was a while before I saw the full performance.
Right.
Because they played Civil War, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and I didn't hear Civil War until it was released for that Romanian benefit album. So for Farm Aid, no. Like, I knew it was going on and just was going crazy because I couldn't watch it anywhere.
You know, I remember Farm Aid 86, oddly enough, because Van Halen headlined, and it was John Cooper Mellencamp's brainchild, apparently. But I didn't get to see the GNR performance until, gosh, at least a year after it aired, and I got a bootleg of it. And I don't know if you remember, famously, it's Steven's last performance with the band.
Right.
But as he's running up to the drum riser, he trips and falls. And it's sort of like an eerie sign of things to come, you know?
Yeah.
And they go right into Civil War, which hadn't been released yet, like you mentioned. And it sounds a little funky. It's a little slow, but it's cool. You know, but it's not their best performance. And in fact, I remember talking to you back, you know, 25 years ago when you mentioned that you thought it was sort of a poor performance.
Did I? I don't remember.
And apparently at this point, the guys, you know, they hadn't done anything publicly in a while. And they were already sort of had gone their own ways and they were doing their own thing. And according, again, to Steven Adler, when they hit the stage, he had no idea what they were going to play. And he had demoed Civil War. They had not actually recorded, or I could be wrong, but I don't think they actually recorded the studio version that, you know, Steven reportedly had so much trouble in. Apparently, Duff just gave him the count in, and he realized what song they were playing, and he jumped in. But when they went to their next song, Down on the Farm, which is an awesome performance of that UK Subs punk classic, it was another thing where Steven said, I had never heard that song before in my life. We never rehearsed it. Duff just said, 1, 2, 3, 4. And Steve just went, doo, 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 doo. As the opening to the song, it fit. And they ended up pulling off a flawless performance. So when he told me that, you know, when I was writing the book with him, I played up that angle to make it seem like the band was already trying to make him look bad, you know, by throwing him out there, throwing him to the wolves without telling him what to play. I don't know if that's true or not. So there's a little bit of a reveal for you.
I had no idea.
But then the Nobody's Child Romanian Relief album comes out, and that was spearheaded, I believe, by George Harrison's wife. And I could be wrong, but I believe that is the case.
Yeah, that is. Olivia Harrison.
Oh, okay, great. Yeah. And this would be the first new Guns N' Roses song that we had gotten since GNR Lies. Yes. And boy, did that thing blow people away.
So that is my other Guns N' Roses as Beatles comparison moment. So I knew that it had come out. I think the radio started playing it before the actual album came out. And so I knew the radio was playing it, and it was during the summer of 1990. And of course, I'm desperate, desperate, desperate to hear this thing. And so I'm out of school. I wake up. First thing I do in the morning is I call at KNAC. Hey, can you guys play that new Guns N' Roses song? Yeah, we'll play it. I sat by the radio from, I think, 10 in the morning until I think it was 9 o'clock at night.
Oh, my God.
And they didn't play it. And I kept calling them. They're like, yeah, we'll play it. I kept calling them. And I think at like 8 o'clock at night, they played Anything Goes. And so at one point during the day, and I'm just hanging out all day, you know, next to my ghetto blaster, ready to hit record. And my mom comes in and goes, oh God, this reminds me of when I was your age and I would sit by the radio waiting for the new Beatles album to come out or waiting for a Beatles song to get played. And when that song would get played, I would just start crying. And I'm like, Mom, you're so lame, whatever. And the song finally gets played at 9 o'clock at night. And when that damn thing came on, I like laid my head on my radio and started crying.
Oh my gosh.
Because I had been waiting by it all day long. And I heard, and thank God the song's amazing.
Right.
I would have been so pissed. Yeah, I think it was just amazing. Absolutely amazing. And then the next morning, I wake up, just casually flip on the radio, and it's on.
You know, it's surprising. I would have thought that KNEC would have been all over that.
At the time, I thought they were deliberately fucking with me. Like, this kid keeps calling up. Let's just not play it.
Right.
Yeah. How could you not play a new Guns N' Roses song in 1990?
Well, I was living at my grandmom's on this porch. It was a porch that had a sliding glass doors that separated to the inside of the house to the outside, you know, backyard. And, the porch is all decorated with posters and everything. I had this little clock radio, cassette player clock radio, that I taped Civil War on. And I'm pretty sure it was 93.3 WMMR in Philadelphia, and I was living in South Jersey. And everybody loved that song, and it just solidified the fact that what everybody was believing, that Guns N' Roses were the next, you know, Led Zeppelin, next Rolling Stones. You know, it was sort of a combination, like I remember thinking, oh, it's like a combination of Lies and Appetite, because you got the acoustic guitar in the beginning, and then it gets, you know, super metalized, in the middle.
And it has deep lyrics.
What's so civil about war anyway?
Yeah, but I think and also it just shows how different being a fan is nowadays. Because nowadays you don't have to sit by the radio all day to hear something. Like, being a fan now is so much instant gratification. Like, we worked for it back then.
We really did. And do you think it's better now, you know, not having those frustrating moments, or do you think it's more rewarding to, you know, wait by the radio for 9 hours, or is that really just a waste of time?
That was pretty miserable. That was a really miserable day. Yeah, I don't know because I don't anticipate things like that anymore, and I'm not a fanatical 15-year-old, so I don't know, you know, it makes for a great in my day story. I don't know, but there definitely was, these insane levels of anticipation, and I would call you the second there would be any even a tentative release date. Like, I would be calling the record store once a week. Like, do you have,
right.
Has the date changed? Has the date changed? And now you just always know. So I don't know. I don't know if it makes you appreciate it less. I don't know if it, clearly I think you're a little bit less insane than I was as a 15-year-old sitting by the radio for like 12 hours.
Well, I could tell you, I didn't go out and buy the Nobody's Child album. I taped it off my little cassette player, and that was good enough for me. And I played it in my car all the time,
Yeah.
So I didn't. Unfortunately, I got the song for free, and I didn't aid those poor Romanian children. Are they doing better now? Do you have any idea? the Romanian children?
I'm not sure. I don't know. They're not so easy to adopt now, so maybe they're doing better. You know, I will say, like, when I did record it off the radio, like, the reception sucked. So I did support the Romanian orphans.
Oh, okay, good. So you
I
bought
did.
It.
Yes, I did.
Good for you.
I'm balancing us out here.
You know, as a team, like, I kind of feel like less guilty, I guess you
could say. I supported them on both of our behalves.
Yeah, so that solidified the fact that, okay, this is a band to be reckoned with, and the comparisons were already being made to Rolling Stones and Led Zeppelin, and they really were like the Rolling Stones. As far as Zeppelin goes, obviously they didn't have the rhythm section. You know, they didn't have John Paul Jones and John Bonham. I mean, that's a rhythm section that hasn't been matched ever. But they did have that rock god persona, and they had the screaming, high-pitched vocals of Led Zeppelin. I mean, you know, Guns N' Roses pictures, you know, photography of Guns N' Roses was exciting to watch, just like it was to watch Led Zeppelin. Rolling Stones, I mean, come on, Bill Wyman, that's the most, I mean, Charlie Watts. The most boring guy in the world. He just looks bored playing.
He always looked like he was about to fall over, even when he was in his 20s.
But I think Guns N' Roses really were a cross between Led Zeppelin and the Rolling Stones, and those comparisons are justified. What do you think?
Oh, for the Rolling Stones? Yeah, comparisons? Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. They, you know, they were the biggest band of their era, and their music still holds up. Like, I don't look back, you know. Like, I was a huge Motley Crue fan, and I still love Motley Crue, but I'll look back and like, oh yeah, I was a huge Motley Crue fan. Uh-huh. Like, Guns N' Roses I still wear very proudly.
Right.
You know, that is a badge of honor that I was that big a fan of theirs before they broke, while they broke, after they broke. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think Slash did cop a little bit of Jimmy Page's look with the double neck. Mm-hmm. You know, it kind of looked like Jimmy Page up there, you know, the double neck guitar.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was like a Jimmy Page favorite, you know.
Oh, yeah. I think they were an amalgamation of all these bands that they were influenced by. Absolutely. They did it well.
Yeah, and you know, they were so popular that, you know, the huge rock stars of the day, you know, like Mick Jagger and Alice Cooper, they were all asked about Guns N' Roses in interviews, and Alice Cooper said they're a great 70s band. That's why they're doing well. They're a great classic 70s band. This is like an 89. And Mick Jagger, and he said, hey, what do you think about the comparisons of Guns N' Roses to Rolling Stones? And Jagger said, well, they're much more heavy metal, aren't they? And he has a point there, but I think...
But the influence is there, you know, especially through Izzy.
Right,
like the Stones' influence is there. Absolutely, absolutely. And they're larger than life. You know, if you can easily make a caricature out of them, they're, you know.
I actually got into an argument with my buddy in 1989, and this is my friend Tony Vertigliano, and I was telling him Guns N' Roses is so popular that everybody knows the name of every member of that band. No, that's not true. And it's like, yes, everybody knows, you know, Axl, Slash, Duff, Steve and Izzy. No. It's like, everybody knows Axl and Slash, but nobody knows the rest of the guys. And it was just this weird kind of argument where he actually came back to me, like, you know, a couple weeks later. Oh, I asked, you know, Mark and Joey, how many members of Guns N' Roses they could name, and they could only come up with Axl and Slash, so you're wrong, you know. But in the circles that I was traveling, everybody knew.
Everybody knew him.
And that's...
Well, everybody knew who Guns N' Roses was. Like, I remember my teacher, my health teacher knew who they were, because I would always, in class... I would always doodle the skulls from the Appetite cover.
Right.
Which I can still do. I actually did it on a baby onesie recently. I did a Slash skull onesie for somebody's baby shower at work. And I was doodling in class, and my teacher walked by and said, like, what? You know, what is that? I'm like, oh, man, it's Guns N' Roses. You know, and he goes, oh, yeah, I like Guns N' Roses. And I, like, rolled my eyes. I'm like, ugh, I bet you do. And he goes, what, you're going to put me down because I like Welcome to the Jungle and Sweet Child of Mine. I'm like, what, in Paradise City, too? So, yeah, like, my teachers knew who Guns N' Roses were. They were huge.
But was that disappointing for you to find out that your teachers liked them?
Yes.
Makes them a little less cool.
Oh, yeah. That was, like, I've always considered myself to be a fairly nice person. Like, one of the times I remember just being a dick at school, I was, like, in gym class, and some girl was singing Paradise City, and I started, like, writing her. Like, what? Paradise City, like, do you even know anything else, you know? Because I was very disappointed my band became that. Like, it was cool on the one hand, but on the other hand, you know, it disappointed me a little bit that my band got that big.
Wow.
So, yeah, I was kind of a dick.
Well, let me run something by you, because you mentioned these skulls, and we were talking about the GNR forums earlier, and I was perusing them earlier today, and over at MyGNR, which I love, but one of the thread questions, you know, one of the topics of a thread was, or no, it wasn't even a, it was stated as a statement, not a question, but it said, Guns N' Roses should rework the cross so that the skulls resemble the new members. So what do you think? Do you think that's a good idea to have the classic Guns N' Roses cross with the five skulls reworked to resemble Frank and Joey and Billy and Tommy and whoever else is in the band?
I don't even know who those, I don't know who those people are. No, of course not.
I mean, isn't that...
Of course not.
That's sort of equal to sacrilege, right? I mean...
I think you could say that, yeah. Yeah, because somebody like... You're just going to confuse like an old person like me. Look at that coat. What's wrong? I know something's wrong. I can't put my finger on it.
And I can guarantee that Axl has enough class that that would never happen. You know, I mean, haven't we been tortured enough when George Lucas kept tweaking with Star Wars? You know, you just leave the classics alone.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
And Appetite and that artwork, it's a classic. And it's just another element of Guns N' Roses' mystique and what made them so special. The artwork, the logo. And it's amazing that Slash designed that classic circle logo,
but, yeah,
know, with the guns.
That's right. That's right.
And Axl still uses it today, I believe, in some capacity. I mean,
does
we
he
still
really?
See it out there. Like, yeah, I believe so. But anyway, back to the kid in the gym class who was singing Paradise City. Did you notice, you know, you've already liked Guns N' Roses since, you know, 87. What was it like to all of a sudden see Guns N' Roses shirts spring up on like every fourth person in your school?
And they sprang up overnight. They sprang up the night after the Aerosmith concert. So everybody, I think that the, I don't know if it was the only shirt they sold at that one was the circle logo shirt. And I had a circle logo shirt that I had bought previously.
And it was the one that said Guns N' Roses was here on the back?
Yeah. And the day after that Aerosmith concert where they opened, everybody had that shirt, and I don't think I ever wore it again.
How funny.
Well, I mean, it was literally overnight. Every, like, you know, the first, because the Aerosmith show was in September of 88. So it was, I think, maybe the third week of school. So the first couple weeks of school, I'd wear my Guns N' Roses shirts, and everybody would be oohing and aahing, and where'd you get that? And then, yeah, then they all had that shirt, and I retired mine.
Well, it wasn't long after that that those shirts became available at every store in the malls. And I think back then, Spencer's was the
Spencer's,
big one.
Spencer's, yeah.
To buy. And my girlfriend had that Guns N' Roses shirt with the circle and said Guns N' Roses was here on the back. And she was a busty girl. And so I think she got like a large or an extra large. Well, it just so happened that it fit me. And next thing you know, I'm the poser wearing the Guns N' Roses shirt. But to be fair, I did like them from early on, as we discussed in the last episode.
Yeah, I remember there was a place at the La Pointe Mall called La Casa de Candles, and it was a head shop, but they had a lot of rock memorabilia, and that was where I got my Guns N' Roses shirts. And my mom, they had one of the Robert Williams painting that was, you know, on the cover of Appetite, and my mom refused to buy it for me.
I don't blame her.
And I couldn't. I don't blame her now. At the time, what's wrong with you, Mom? And now I'm like, oh, thank God she didn't let me walk around wearing that shirt.
And, you know, you actually open up a world of memories when you mention the head shop, because in the malls in New Jersey, at Echelon Mall and Deptford Mall, it was a place called, a shop called East. And it was all these, like, you know, like Chinese-inspired, like, knickknacks. But in the back was the head shop with the black lights and the black light posters. And they had all the cool stick. So I don't know why these are my best memories, but going into the head shops and buying, you know, rock merchandise, you know, from the early 80s even, like Ozzy, you know, and Iron Maiden.
That's where we get the stickers and and the candle shop at the La Pointe Mall, they had snapshots.
Yes.
So they had like those 4x5
snapshots.
And
they have binders.
Yes.
That you could, see, kids, you don't have this today. You know, these head shops where they would, oh, by the way, a head shop is a place where you could buy drug paraphernalia, usually water pipes, you know, bongs.
Or scales to weigh your gold.
Right, exactly. Your gold, in quotes. And they had the coolest rock memorabilia. And if you look for this stuff on eBay now, a lot of it's pretty pricey because I had like AC/DC posters and stuff. And, you know, they go for a pretty penny. And the Guns N' Roses stuff that I got, I remember I got like a Guns N' Roses sticker and I put it on a photo album that a girlfriend and I shared. And I still have it. And I still have that classic GNR sticker. I got patches, Guns N' Roses patches.
Yes.
And I got the back patch of the Robert Williams artwork, meaning the full back thing to go on like a denim jacket.
Yeah.
And I never put it on one because I could never find a denim jacket that fit right for some reason. It's the weirdest thing. But yeah, those are good times.
I still have my denim vest with my Guns N' Roses patches.
Sweet.
Yeah. Although I drew Alistair Fiend on the back, so I did not get the large Guns N' Roses back patch.
Oh, well, did it look cool, the Alistair Fiend?
It looked really good.
Oh, wow.
I have to dig it up. I think it's in my closet here.
That's the Motley Crue mascot for anybody.
And then I went and would get buttons. But I would find buttons that mirrored what Slash had. Because Slash always had buttons on his denim.
Exactly.
So anytime I found a button that Slash had, I would put that on.
I ruined a leather jacket by putting buttons on it. Slash made buttons cool. You know, people don't remember this. This is something that, you know, in 88, when all of the pictures, Slash had the denim vest on top of the leather jacket, and on the vest were
all the buttons.
Do you remember any of them?
I remember there was the image of like a bull shitting, which had the circle and the cross on it.
Right.
Oh, he had Batman. What else did he have? I think he had to keep abortion safe and legal. Yeah, I should go pull out my denim vest and we could see everything Slash
political
had.
Activist Slash.
Yes.
Yeah, and I think at the time the only shirts they had was the circle logo, and then they did come out with one after Lies came out that, you know, was the Lies artwork, one sided only, and then they had one for Used to Love Her, and that was like a weird design. It wasn't even like an image, I don't think, but it said Used to Love Her, Guns N' Roses.
I don't think I had that one.
Yeah, I never managed to obtain that one myself.
Well, and then there were shirts for Lies, and I don't know if they were official or not, but there were Lies shirts of each band member.
Yes.
But I don't know because I had a Slash one. I don't know if those were official or not.
They were, and dude, I remember in 91, you know, when I was in California at this point, and seeing those in the shops, and I was a big Guns N' Roses fan, and I passed on those, and I had the opportunity to buy them. They had Axl, Slash, even Steven. Steven's, each shirt had a song affiliated with it.
Yeah.
Axl was One in a Million, and it quoted like a verse. Steven's was Night Train. I don't remember what Slash was.
I remember what Slash's was.
And I don't even know if I ever saw the Duff and Izzy one. I'm sure they made them for them.
They did. They did.
And I remember seeing them and thinking, no, that's a little too gay. Like, why would I want to, you know?
Yeah.
And I regret it to this day because I've seen them on eBay. Like, the Axl one, I could have sworn I've seen go for like $250.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, gosh. They're that rare, but they're that cool.
Yeah, yeah. And then I found, I think this was a bootleg shirt, at the Orange County Swap Meet. There was a booth that sold rock memorabilia, and it's a like a caricature of Axl as a skeleton, and he has a gun pointing straight at you.
I remember that one.
Was that official?
No, that wasn't official.
Oh, I wore that thing. Oh, my gosh. Like, I had to sew. It would fall apart, and I would sew it up. I wore it so much.
Well, in New Jersey, we didn't have swap meets, we had what were called marts. Mm-hmm. And they were sort of like the same thing, but they were like these big enclosed swap meets, basically. And you would walk in and basically get a rash because it was so like white trash and low class, you know. But anyway, you talk about those fake shirts. Man, I got suckered into one of those bootleg fake shirts. I bought what I thought was a Judas Priest shirt. I thought it said Judas Priest, ram it down. And it had like this, you know, like robot ramming a flying V down, you know. And I actually loved the Ram It Down album by Judas Priest. So I was like, oh, cool. I've never seen this. So I bought it. Got it home. Guess what it actually said? High Priest of Rock, Ram It Down. But the logo was exactly the same as Judas Priest. You know, the priest was perfect. And I just thought it said Judas Priest, but no, it was High Priest of Rock.
See, now my Axl one, it might not, I don't remember. It might not have even said Guns N' Roses. It was cool, though. So I wore that one. Once I retired my circle logo shirt, I wore that one a lot.
You know, one other thing I wanted to talk about before we wrap this up was the 1989 MTV Awards, when they won the award for Sweet Child of Mine.
Okay.
And Axl performs with Tom Petty.
Oh, yeah, Free Falling.
Yeah, do you have any special memories of seeing that particular event? Yeah,
well, I remember before the show aired, Kurt Loder had done an exclusive interview with Axl, and they showed it before the awards show.
Oh, is that
show.
When they aired? Yeah. That was the one where Axl's
He's
in the backyard?
By the pool, yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, and he, yeah. And that was like this really like in-depth interview, and so that's what's really strong for me. Is and he's, you know, and he's really cool in that interview. So I remember watching it and, you know, and just being anxious and hoping, you know, that they're actually going to have a second album out. And yeah, and then again when he comes out on stage, because I don't think we knew he was going to come out on stage with Tom Petty. So when he did, yeah, lost my mind.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And it's funny because, you know, Tom Petty is the closing number and he's doing his huge hit Free Falling, which was huge at the time.
It was huge, but I remember thinking, still, why the hell is Tom Petty closing out this show? And then Axl came on. I was like, oh,
and the place goes
that's
wild.
That's why.
And yeah. It is an awesome rendition of Free Falling. But then as the end credits roll, they go into Heartbreak Hotel. Now, you may not, I'm sure you know this, that Guns N' Roses used to do Heartbreak Hotel, you know, like in 86. And so Axl is singing like the Guns N' Roses version, and he's going wild on stage to the point where you look at Tom Petty, and Tom Petty is amused looking at Axl, just giving it his all. And it's a pretty funny bit of video, and it's something that I love to watch from time to time.
I have no recollection of Heartbreak Hotel.
Yeah, it came right after Free Falling, as the credits were rolling. And Duff and Steven accept the award for Sweet Child of Mine. Tommy Lee and Nikki Sixx, I believe. No, Tommy Lee, it might have been Vince Neil that actually presented the award.
God, I like only vaguely recall.
Yeah.
It wasn't Slash, so I just didn't, I guess I just didn't hang on.
You know what?
Hang
on to that memory. That's an interesting point that you make. I don't think Slash was.
I don't think he was there.
Yeah. But in our next episode, we're going to get into an award ceremony that Slash was at and caused a bit of a controversy. But it's getting a little late here in North Hollywood once again, so we're going to bid you all a fond adieu until the next month, the next few weeks, when we release our next episode. So have a good night.
And we'll see you soon.
See you soon.
Original music produced by Brooke Ellis. All Jungle Natives content, all rights reserved.